Thanks. I'm happy to be here. I like Georgia. And I flew in today. I want to thank the committee and Terry for picking me up and the committee for inviting me down. You know, I go to a lot of these deals and you fly into airports and you just never know who's going to pick you up at the airport, you know? And normally, you fly into an airport, you go down the escalator into baggage. Standing there are two or three guys. They got black suits on, and they're holding nice signs with your name on it. And I flew into North Carolina a couple years ago, and I went down the escalator into baggage. Standing there, two or three guys, little black suits, nice printed signs. And standing next to them is a guy. He's got on a pair of shorts and a Hawaiian shirt. And he's holding a piece of cardboard, doesn't say anything on it. I guess he's protected my anonymity. But I am happy to be here. You know, I'm pretty sure what I'm going to say up here tonight. But I'm not pretty sure what you're going to hear, huh? And there's a story I like to tell. It's a story about a state trooper. And that state trooper, he's just sitting on the side of the road, waiting for somebody to go by and do something wrong, because that's what state troopers do. And sure enough, on that day, a boy went driving by in a pickup truck. And the back of that pickup truck was full of penguins. And that trooper, he knew there was something wrong with that. He pulled him over. He says, "Son, where are you going with all those penguins in the back of that pickup truck?" He said, "Well, officer, we're not going anywhere. We're just out for a ride." He said, "Boy, what's wrong with you? You can't take penguins for a ride. You take those penguins to the zoo." And he said, "Yes, sir." Well, that next day, that trooper's in the same spot. Here come that boy one more time. Back of that pickup truck, still full of penguins. But on that day, all those penguins are wearing sunglasses. And he pulled them over again. He says, "Son, I thought I told you to take those penguins to the zoo." He said, "Well, yes, sir, I did. Today we're going to the beach." We all kind of see and hear things differently, don't we? You can be listening to the same speaker I'm listening to. You can be looking at the same speaker I'm looking at. And you're going to see one thing, I'm going to see one thing. You're going to hear one thing, I'm going to hear one thing. Let me give you an example. There's a room. It's a big room. Got a table in the middle of the room. Sitting in the middle of that table is a $100 bill. Now standing around that table is the perfect man, the perfect woman, Santa Claus, and the Easter Bunny. And the lights went out. Those lights went back on. That $100 bill was gone. Y'all know who took it, right? It had to be the perfect woman because those other three things don't exist. My name's Tim Towsley. I'm an alcoholic. I did not want to be an alcoholic. My daddy was an alcoholic. He was a member of this fellowship. He got sober in 1946. He passed away in 1980. He had 10 years of continuous sobriety put together at that time in his life. And what that did for me early in my life, it gave me an opportunity to see what an alcoholic was all about. To see what alcoholism was all about. And also to see what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. I came from a family where I had 6 stepfathers. I had 13 stepmothers. I went to over 20 schools. I never got out of the 8th grade. I've been married 3 times and divorced twice. I left home when I was 14 years old. I've had an opportunity in my life to spend time in boys' homes, detention homes, city jails, county jails, workhouses, psych wards, treatment centers, and penitentiaries. I spent 12 years of my adult life either on probation, parole, or locked behind some kind of door somewhere. And you know, not one of those things I just talked about are the reasons I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those were merely the situations my disease of alcoholism created in my life. But on June 23rd, 1982, I woke up at the bottom. And that's the bottom they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's when you know a loneliness such as few men know. It's when you're at that jumping off place. You're wishing for the end. You can no longer imagine life with or life without alcohol. And that's the bottom. That's not a high bottom, but it's not a low bottom either, see? It's just my bottom. And my bottom is the only bottom I ever need to concern myself with in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't ever want to be in a position in my sobriety where I can sit out in a room, listen to a speaker speak, and start thinking things like, you know, maybe I wasn't that bad, huh? Or I could sit out there and start thinking like, maybe I was worse. I don't ever want to be in a position in my sobriety where I can listen to a speaker speak in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can put myself in a place where I'm unique. I don't ever want to be unique in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just want to be a regular alcoholic. I had my first drink at 13. I got sick. I passed out. I blacked out. I woke up in the backyard of a lady's house in Rocky River, Ohio. I had my last drink at 30, and I got sick, and I blacked out, and I passed out, and I woke up at home in bed. You know, that's the only difference. 17 years of use and abuse, the only real difference was where I woke up the next morning. But I know one thing for sure today. I know that God wants me in Alcoholics Anonymous. That lady came out of her back door. She found me in her backyard. She took me in her house. She cleaned me up. She found out who I was. She called my mama, let my mama know I'd be okay. 17 years later, I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a meeting. I was about 2 weeks sober. I walked into a meeting, and that woman was speaking at that meeting. Huh? My very first drunk, I found myself in the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she did for me that night all she knew how to do. She was sober about 60 days the night she found me in her backyard. And what they told her to do at her home group was help a drunk. They didn't tell her only help the old drunks or the young drunks. The male drunks or the female drunks. The black drunks or the white drunks. They told her to help a drunk. Period. And that's what she did that night. And do you know, I still see that woman at meetings today. She just turned 94 years old. And she's coming up on 50 years sober. You know what she's doing? She's helping drunks, man. There's two things I ran from most of my life. I'm not crazy about them today. I got a lot of them in my life today. I still don't like them, but I don't run from them. I deal with them. And those two things are responsibility and authority. I don't like being responsible. I don't know if y'all know, but there's a lot of responsibility involved with being responsible. And I certainly don't like people telling me I'm supposed to be responsible. It seemed like at 13 and 14 years old, everybody had an idea about Tim's life. How long his hair should be, how tight his jeans should be, how high the heels on his boots should be, go to school, don't go to school. Everybody had an idea. No one asked him. I'm at a family gathering one night, and I'm listening to people talk. And somebody said this. They said, my daddy, my real daddy, was in New Orleans. And he was sober. And with that information, I left home the next day because I knew what my problem was. It wasn't what I was doing or who I was doing it with. My problem was I didn't have my real father in my life. If I could get my real father in my life, everything would be okay. And I made my way to New Orleans. I contacted Alcoholics Anonymous. They found my daddy for me, and they put us together. And all of a sudden, I had a father, and he had a son. And we tried to be those two things, but neither one of us had ever been either of those two things before. We did the best we could. We just didn't know what we were doing. After about 30 or 40 days, I learned something else. My daddy started drinking again. And I can remember coming home, 13, 14 years old, passing out in my mother's living room, and the next morning having her scream at me, son, don't drink. Please don't drink. You'll get what your father has. But I didn't see what she was trying to get me, keep me from getting until I saw him drink. I watched him get drunk. I watched him go into the DTs. I watched the people from Alcoholics Anonymous come into our little apartment, take him away and put him in Bridge House. And I made a decision on that day. I'm not going to be an alcoholic. I'm not going to end up like my daddy ended up. And I didn't have another drink for the next 4 years. I really didn't do much anything for the next 4 years. I just hitchhiked all around this country. If I woke up in Dallas, didn't like it there, I'd go to New Orleans. New Orleans didn't please me, I was off to Miami. You see, all of a sudden, here I am. I'm in the city of New Orleans. I've got no responsibility. I've got no authority. I got the rest of my life to go wherever it is I think I want to be, do whatever it is I think I want to do. And it's 1966. And I guess I was a hippie. At least that's what folks called me. And I had 4 good years. My expectations were met. If I had a sleeping bag, a pack of cigarettes, and something to eat, it was a good day. That's all I needed. My expectations were met. Now, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me this, that my expectations are inversely proportional to my serenity level. And I don't know about you, but I know about me today. I can tell you this about me. Do you know if I get exactly, I mean exactly, what I think I'm supposed to have, exactly when I think I'm supposed to have it, I'm a pretty happy guy, huh? But as soon as I don't, my expectations aren't met and my serenity level goes down. 18 years old, I don't want to play anymore. I want some stuff. I'm seeing people in their backyards as we're hitchhiking by. They're in their backyards, they're mowing the grass, they're painting the garage, they're playing with their dog, they're in their backyard, and all of a sudden I want some of this American dream. I want some of the things they have. You know the stuff, the billboards tell me I'm supposed to have. If I drive this kind of car, I'm okay. If I wear these kind of clothes, I'm okay, and if I live in that kind of neighborhood, you know, then I'm okay. And all of a sudden at 18, I want to be okay. And me and a buddy of mine left Berkeley, California, and I'm coming back to Cleveland. We started hitchhiking out of Berkeley, and we got a ride into Utah. To this day, I don't know where I was in Utah. He dropped us off at an off-ramp that didn't have any gas stations, no houses, no convenience stores, no nothing. This was just a road in the middle of Utah that went farther up into the middle of nowhere, Utah. And that's where we got dropped off. We woke up the next morning. It's cold in the mountains in the morning. We woke up in the morning about froze to death and decided we was going to go down the on-ramp and see if we had better luck today. We got down to that on-ramp. 6 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of Utah, all by itself, sitting there is a six-pack of Olympia beer. I know God wants me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank 3 beers. He drank 3 beers. I looked at him. I said, you know, if I ever get back home, I'm settling down. I'm going to marry the first girl I see. You got to have the girl. That's all part of this American dream. I did get back home alive. I stopped at my parents' house. My stepfather wasn't there, so I was allowed in. I took a shower. I changed my clothes. I borrowed my mother's car, drove to the corner to get a pack of cigarettes, picked the young lady up hitchhiking, and we got married. Now, we get married that day, but we might have. But back then in the state of Ohio, the male had to be 21 or have parental consent. And the female had to be 18 or have parental consent. And when I married my first wife, I was 18 and she was 15. And this was not a marriage that was made in heaven. We didn't know anything about being married. We didn't know anything about being in love. I can't tell you to this day if I love that girl. I can tell you this. I live in my brother's van in the driveway of my parents' home because I haven't been allowed in their house since I'm 14 years old. She lives wherever she can because there's things going on in her house she doesn't want to go back to. And that brought us together, see. We weren't alone anymore. And that was enough, just not to be alone. And it was a simple marriage. I got up in the morning, I got drunk. She got up in the morning, she got drunk. And then we'd beat each other up. And we did that one day at a time for about 7 years. But out of that 7 years, I was away a lot. I travel a lot. I travel a lot today. I travel a lot then. But this part of my life was a little different. I'd walk into a room, big room like this. There'd be a man sitting up front. He'd have a long black coat on. And every time he did this, I went somewhere. I just always in trouble. I'm a child of the 60s. Seemed like 12 years of my life, I only did two things. I got ready to go to jail, and I got ready to come home from being in jail. Now, I wasn't a violent criminal. I was a stupid criminal. I got arrested for stupid stuff. I got arrested for stuff like verbal abuse of a police officer. And that was in a little city called Parma, Ohio. I got arrested for obscene finger language to a police officer. And that was in Parma, Ohio. And if y'all don't know anything about Parma, Ohio, I want to tell you this. They got no sense of humor, man. I was at a meeting one night. I was about 2 years sober. And I don't know about anybody else. 2 years sober, I was pretty close to the smartest person in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 2 years sober. You ever go to a meeting, you hear somebody say something? You know you've heard that same person say that same thing 50 times, right? But now, all of a sudden, it made sense. There was a long timer talking. His name was Vic, and I miss Vic. He's passed on. But Vic was my guy. You got one? Vic was my guy. If I walked into a room and Vic was in it, I already felt better. Vic didn't even have to know I was there. He didn't have to talk to me. I didn't have to talk to him. But if Vic was there, I knew it was going to be better. And Vic was speaking that night. And he stood up here and he said this. He said, I've been arrested 63 times. I wasn't a good criminal. Man, I picked right up on that. I wasn't a good criminal. People that got caught doing what I was doing as many times as I got caught weren't real good at their doing. I learned something else in that verbal abuse case of a police officer. I decided to represent myself in that case. What's so funny? I just knew I saw enough Perry Mason, judge for the defense. I can do this. I went to court. I called witnesses. I cross-examined witnesses. I gave my final arguments to the judge. You know what I found out, right? I'm not a very good attorney either, man. Back to the workhouse. 1975, I stood in front of a judge in an old Lakeside courthouse in downtown Cleveland, and he sentenced me to 20 to 40 years in the penitentiary. And I took a big sigh of relief on that day. I felt good on that day. I felt better than I had in a long time on that day. I can hear my wife and my mother in the back of the courtroom. They're crying. They don't think I should go away, and they certainly don't want me to go for that long. But you see, they don't know what I know. On that day, I know this. I know they can't send me anywhere that's going to hurt me as much as I'm hurting myself. And that judge didn't get it. He didn't know he couldn't punish me any more than I've already punished myself. And I'm ready to go anywhere just to have a better chance against myself. Now, in 1976, the laws in Ohio changed. My sentence went from a 20 to 40 to a 1 to 10. And 3 years later, they sent me home. But when I got home, all my stuff was gone. All the stuff you got to have was gone. All the stuff I needed to be okay was gone. My wife was gone. My car was gone. My motorcycle's gone. My jewelry, my clothes, everything's gone. There was nothing left there but me. And I didn't do anything for the next 30 or 40 days but drink. I crawled into a bottle of alcohol. I got as drunk as I could, blacked out as I could, passed out as I could, as many times that day as I needed to. And not once in my life have I ever crawled into a bottle of alcohol to hide from you. Never have I crawled into a bottle of alcohol to hide from them. I got as drunk as I could, blacked out as I could, passed out as I could, as many times that day as I needed to. I crawled into that bottle to hide from me. I knew what I was. I was an ex-con. I was an ex-husband. I was an ex-brother. I was an ex-son. But if I was drunk enough, I didn't have to look. Finally, a friend of mine came over, took me out of my house almost physically. He says, "You're not going to sit here and drink yourself to death. You're out of prison. It's time to start living. You're coming with me." And he took me down to a little place we call the Flats in Cleveland. Flats used to be a really nice place to go get drunk. That's what you did in the Flats. You got drunk. Then they yuppied it all up. You never went to the Flats to have dinner. You didn't go to the Flats on your boat. You certainly never went to the Flats to drink something that came from something called a microbrewery. You drank Past Blue Ribbon beer and Jim Beam bourbon and you got drunk and all the barroom floors were flooded. It was a wonderful place. We walked into a little bar called the Pirate's Cove that night. My cousin's band was playing. They're playing a Marshall Tucker song. I'm drinking Past Blue Ribbon beer and I'm about half in the bag. And this pretty little girl walked past me and she smiled at me. You know, I smiled right back at her. That was her. That was my future ex-wife. Who shall heretofore be known as the plaintiff. That's who that was. Let me tell you about my second wife. When she came into my home, she brought some things with her. She brought some stuff I think I had, I just don't know where it was. She brought things with her like honesty. She brought purity. She brought unselfishness and she brought love. And these are the things she came with. And 4 years later, she left. The only thing she had to take with her was the disease of alcoholism. It stripped every decent thing she had. I am not the only one I hurt when I pick up a drink, and I know that today. I tried for a couple years to do the right thing. Went to work, didn't call in sick, was never late. I tried to do the right thing for 2 years. And you know, after 2 years, I'm sitting on my couch one night, drunk, surveying my dynasty, huh? After 2 years, do you know I don't have a house on the lake? I don't have a Porsche in the driveway. I don't belong to the right kind of clubs, and I'm not running around with the right kind of people after 2 years. So I came to a conclusion and made a decision that those things were for other people, and I'm just one of the people that's not supposed to have them. So I got up the next morning, called my boss, and quit my job. In the last 2 years of my drinking aren't too exciting. I got up, I got drunk. My wife lasted about another 2 years, and then she had to go. And this is my life at 30 years old. You know those family gatherings we have? Maybe it's Thanksgiving or Easter, Mother's Day. We're going to go somewhere, huh? We're going to sit at a table. We'll hold hands. We'll say grace. We'll share a meal with each other. When we're done eating, we're just going to sit around and we're going to share what's going on in each other's lives. This is the way it works at my house. I pull into my parents' driveway and I blow the horn. When they hear the horn inside, my little brother comes out of the back door. He has a paper plate in his hand. It's wrapped in tinfoil. And he hands me my holiday meal. And I can sit in my car and eat my holiday meal off a paper plate with a plastic knife and a plastic fork. I can't hold their hands and say grace. They don't want me to share anything with them that's going on in my life at that time. But I don't want you to think they stopped loving me. Not even this much. You see, they simply realized every time they reached down and stopped me from hitting my bottom, every time they allowed me not to be responsible for my own actions, they were killing me. You see, my parents loved me so much, they let me go. I don't have any children. I can only imagine how much love that must take. June 23rd, 1982, I woke up at that bottom I told you about, and I didn't know what to do. And when I didn't know what to do, I always did the same thing. I made a phone call. I don't know if I made that phone call 100 times or 1,000 times. It was the same call. It was, Mom, help. I couldn't go to her, but she would always come to me. She walked into my little house. I'm kneeling on the living room floor. I'm shaking apart. I'm crying uncontrollably. I have hepatitis, and I weigh 112 pounds. And the first words out of my mother's mouth were, I'll kill her for doing this to you. Alcoholism. This is a family disease. Blaming others is a big part of this disease, and my mother has it too. I found myself in an emergency room. I got a doctor playing with my liver. He says, son, you got an alcohol problem. And I said, no. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I kept telling him I didn't want to be an alcoholic. He said, I don't care what you want to be or don't want to be. If you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. And I heard him say that. And I spent the next 10 days in a psych ward on the east side of Cleveland. The first three in restraints. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. That sounded a little bit like step one, didn't it? A little bit. I got a psychiatrist in my psych ward. I got the happiest psychiatrist on earth in my psych ward. And he comes to visit me early in the morning, every morning, happy. Tim, how you doing? Good to see you. Isn't this a marvelous day? Now, I don't know about the rest of y'all. 7 o'clock in the morning? In a psych ward on the east side of Cleveland, tied to the bed. I'm not real spiritual, man. I'm just not. I told him what I thought, and he just did what psychiatrists do. Y'all know what they do, right? They write in their charts and nod their heads. That's what they do. And pretty soon they make you take that test, don't they? Did you ever take that test? Man, if I had a nickel for every time I took the test. Every time they sent me somewhere, they made me take this test. The MMPI test. It's got 600 questions on it. There's only one question on that test I can't answer. It's my favorite question on the whole MMPI test. It says, do you urinate more than most people? I don't know. On the third day, he came into my room. I don't want to forget this day, and I have it. He put his chart in the windowsill. He undid the straps, and he sat on my bed. He said, Tim, I can't make your wife come home. I don't have a job to give you. I won't make a house payment for you. But if you never want to take another drink as long as you live, I can tell you how to do that, one day at a time. You see, this psychiatrist was a recovering member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that God wants me here. He sat on the edge of my bed and he shared a little bit of his story with me. And then I shared a little bit of my story with him. And now, all of a sudden, it was no longer, I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. All of a sudden it became we. Huh? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable, and that's step one. And I know without the we, I don't have a prayer, man. 7 days later, he sent me home. He gave my prescription. I think it's the most valuable thing anybody's ever given me in my life. He gave me a meeting scheduled, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, when you get home, I want you to go to a meeting. When you get to that meeting, you get a sponsor. And I got home, and I didn't know what to do. And I told y'all what I do when I don't know what to do. I called my mama. I said, Ma, I got to go to an AA meeting. She said, I'll come get you. See, my mom knows all about Alcoholics Anonymous. She went to meetings with my daddy in the 40s and the 50s. There's been a big book in my house as long as I can remember. And she dropped me on your doorstep. That was July 4th, 1982. She left me with a little advice I want to share with you. She said, I'm not coming back to get you. You go to the front table, you tell the people at the front table you're new. You don't have a car, you don't have a driver's license, you need a ride home. And you stay away from the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I paid attention to just about half of my mama's advice. But I got a sponsor that night. He gave me stuff to do that night. His wife was the chairperson. She added me to traditions, asked me if I'd read, and I backed up. I said, gee, I don't know, honey. You know, they just took the straps off me. You might want to find someone else to do that. And he just looked at me. You know how they look at you. He said, it's your first lesson in AA. You never say no to Alcoholics Anonymous. Whatever the request is, the answer is yes. That's all you're ever going to need to know about that. He said, if you sat in a chair, you put it away. If you had a coffee cup, you throw it away. He said, if you use an ashtray, now that's a long time ago when AA was civilized. He said, you empty it. He said, I want you to read one page of the big book every day. Don't turn the page until tomorrow. Read it as many times that day as you want to or think you need to. Do not turn the page until tomorrow. And maybe, Tim, just maybe in 164 days, you might know something about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he got me active. He asked me that question. You know, I'm a firm believer. I don't have a lot of opinions from up here, but let me give you one. Newcomers come in here, and sometimes we say dumb stuff to newcomers, you know? I don't know if you heard this one. My sponsor asked me, he said, do you want what I have? I don't know, buddy. What do you got? You know, do I want what you have? Because I don't know about you. When I got here, I did not want what you had. The only thing I knew for sure when I got here was that I didn't want what I had. And God put people like you in my path to show me another way. I came to believe by watching you, if I did what you did, I could have what you had. And that's what I did. I went to the meetings you went to. I sat at the tables you sat at. I folded my raffle tickets the way you folded your raffle tickets. If you had cream in your coffee, I had cream in my coffee. I don't like cream in my coffee. My sponsor said, if you're not praying, this is how you're going to start. You're going to take three words your mama taught you when you're a little boy. You're going to get up in the morning, kneel down, and you'll say, please. You go about your day at the end of that day. When you haven't had a drink, you're going to kneel back down and say, thank you. Please and thank you. You know, my mama did teach me those words when I was a little boy. Do you know what she called them? They're magic words, huh? What's the magic word, Timmy? No matter what I wanted, it was what's the magic word. I had no idea how much magic those words held till I came here to you and you showed me how to use them. I knelt down, I said a third step prayer. I wasn't crazy about the third step. I don't know what y'all thought first time you saw it. First time I read it, I thought, what if it works, right? Then what? So my sponsor comes over. I said, we're going to kneel down. He said, yeah. I said, I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. He said, that's what we're going to do. I said, then what? He said, we don't know. I said, No, that's not good enough. You got to have something for me. You got to give me something. And he did. And if you got one, you can understand the third step too. I always have one. It's a penny. It's a special penny. This penny's from 1918. That's the year my mama was born. And if you look at the back of the penny, it's going to say 1 cent. But do you know what happens as soon as you turn it over? On the front of the penny it says, "In God we trust." And that's the third step. It's not about God's will. It's about my will. Am I willing to trust God with it today? I can tell you I am. And once you can do that, there's another word on the front of that penny. And that word's liberty. Freedom you can have just by trusting God one day at a time. I started on that fourth step, but most of y'all know that's not one you rush right into, right? No, seriously, you really got to take your time with that fourth step because you got to read all them books. If we don't have anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, buddy, we got books. We got blue books, we got blue and blue books. We got little blue books, little black books, little green books, little red books. We got lists, we got guides. We even have experts in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And if you don't read all them books, talk to every old-timer in the world, you're going to mess the fourth step up, aren't you? No. There's only one way to do the fourth step wrong. Don't do it. That's the only way you can mess the fourth step up. I read all those books. I talked to every old-timer in Cleveland. I'm sober 33 years, and I'm still not 100% sure what Mr. Jones's problem is. I did a fourth and a fifth step. I wrote down what happened. I shared with God and another human being why it happened. And then I had to become entirely ready for this stuff to go away. Become entirely ready for it to have it go away. Have you read it? Why wouldn't you want it to go away as quick as possible? But I couldn't do it by myself. I had to humbly ask a power greater than myself for help, and he showed me the way. I moved to my eighth step, and I'm looking at my list. My sponsor's coming over, because we're moving along on this deal, and that's just the way he was. And I'm looking at this guy over here. I did that. I don't dispute it. Guilty. But you know, he did this to me. I scratch him off the list, man. That's a push. No, we're even. And I'm steady scratching people off the list waiting for my sponsor to get over there. He gets over there. There's no one on my list but my mama. He said, "You don't understand this, do you?" I said, "I think I'm doing pretty good with it, man." He said, "This has nothing to do with them. Their faults will not be discussed. This is about you. And the first thing you need to do is learn to forgive. Until you can forgive everybody that ever wronged you, you will never have the right to ask anybody else for forgiveness. I make direct amends to the people I've wronged. And do you know, before I was halfway through that ninth step, those promises came true, just like the book says. I have that Porsche in the driveway today. I keep it disguised as a Toyota, though, you know. No, that's just so no one will steal it. Maybe you'll see it someday. You'll come to Ohio and you'll see it. You'll say, "Man, that's no Porsche. That's a Toyota." But you got to remember this. There's only one person here right now that's looking out of your eyes. And that's the only person that's ever going to be responsible for what you see. You can see good or you can see bad. But you're the one looking. When I get to the airport on Sunday, I'm going to get inside my car. Alcoholics Anonymous is an inside job. I spent most of my life believing that if I could make the outside look good enough, the inside would feel better. Till I came here and you showed me how to work from the inside out. And I'm going to get inside my car, and I'm not going to see Toyota. I'm going to see Porsche. Carrera. 4S Turbo. It's triple black. Got a Bose CD system in it with a 12-disc changer. And I'm going to hit those power windows. Huh? And on Monday, I'll go to my job. You know the job I didn't used to have when I was drinking? And I'll see my friends. Those would be the friends I didn't used to have when I was drinking. You see, I don't know who has your message. Are you sitting out there waiting for somebody with 70 years of sobriety? Because just maybe the person that God sent with your message today isn't even going to get sober for 70 more minutes. But I know this today. If there's somebody talking and I can hear them, God wants me to listen. I got a message on the first step about 22 years ago. I was invited to speak in Indiana. My wife couldn't go with me that weekend, so I took one of my new guys with me. And I didn't want to take my car because I didn't think my car would make it to Indiana. So I took my wife's car. And she's driving a Honda Civic back then. And y'all know in a Honda Civic, what do you get in a Honda Civic? 300-400 miles to a gallon in a Honda Civic, right? No, really. You drive a Honda Civic pretty much from now on. Never have to put gas in a Honda Civic. Me and my new guy, we headed for Valparaiso, Indiana. We went underneath the sign that said my exit was about 5 exits away. And I looked down at the gas gauge. And it said empty. And I thought, well, yeah, in a real car, empty, empty. But, right, in a Honda Civic, empty, you got to have 100 miles left. There's only 50 in Indiana. I never gave it another thought. Until we went underneath the sign that said my exit was 2 miles. As soon as I went underneath that sign, I ran out of gas. If you got a Honda Civic and it says empty, you know, they're dead serious about that. That's that's exactly what they mean. So I coasted for another mile, and I pulled off to the side of the road. There I was on the side of the road, out of gas, middle of Indiana. Got a new guy sitting next to me. You know, I don't even want to turn and look at him. Now, I just spent the better part of about 4 hours telling him all about responsibility and stuff like that. But I had to do something. I couldn't sit in Indiana the rest of my life, so I turned and I looked at him. He just grinned. You know how they are. They'll stay sober a long time waiting for you to do something wrong just so they can point it out. And he looked at me and he said, "We're powerless, ain't we?" I said, "Yeah, you bet we are." I said, "What do you think we ought to do about it?" He said, "Well, I think we better admit it." If I never admit there's a problem, I have no reason to seek a solution. I don't know who has your message. Do you? Are you listening? I take one word out of each of the last 3 steps. That's how I live my life today. Continue, improve, and practice. Each one of those words is an action word. You want something, you got to do something. My book tells me half measures avail me nothing. It doesn't say half measures avail me half. It says nothing. And I don't know about you. Man, I've had more nothing in my life than I want. I don't want any more nothing. I want everything God wants me to have. And I don't even know what that is. There's a difference in my life today I'll share with you. I used to do it a lot more, go to the prisons and talk to the guys in the penitentiaries in the state. I used to do it a lot more, and they changed some rules in Ohio. It used to be you just put your name on a list and you go. But now they want you to fill an application out to go into the penitentiaries. I never had to fill an application out to get into a penitentiary before. Oh, no, I was always pre-approved when I got there. But a while back, long while back, I gave a little talk in Allen Correctional Institute in Western Ohio. And a guy came up to me after the meeting. And he said, "Can I call you?" I said, "Yeah, you call me." I forgot. You want to call somebody from the penitentiary, you got to call collect. But I'll accept a collect phone call in my life today. Let me tell you why. On April 10th, 1989, I went to a meeting. There was a young lady speaking at the meeting that night. And I don't know what your sponsor told you. My sponsor used to tell me this quite a bit. He said, "Tim, if you go to a meeting and you hear something you like, take it home." Y'all are a sick bunch, you know that. And on October 16th, 1993, we got married. I married a young lady in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her name's Mary. I married a very intelligent woman in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, very educated. Now, a lot of people, they didn't think she's so smart when she said she'd marry me. But it's true. My wife got more letters after her name than I got in my name. She's got a B.A. She has an M.A. She has an M.A.C.T. She was A.B.D. Then she got a Ph.D. And then she got my personal favorite. And that's a J.O.B. One of my new guys asked me once, he said, "Doesn't that intimidate you? That your wife's so educated, your wife's so intelligent, doesn't that intimidate you?" And I stopped and think about it for a minute, because I never had before. And I thought, no, it doesn't intimidate me, it makes me proud. I am proud as hell of my wife's accomplishments. Because 27 years ago, she came through that door. And she didn't have any letters after her name. But because of a God of her understanding, a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and the women in her home group that told her, once you come through that door, if you're willing to do the work, you can be anything you want to be. She trusted God, she worked hard, and she accomplished. I can't be intimidated by that. Only proud. I am proud just to be a member of something that could make that happen. I'm so proud I got new license plates for my car. Yeah, I got those vanity plates down here in Georgia. God, I think they're the stupidest thing I ever saw. But I got some. You know what my license plates say? They say PhD, GED. I got letters after my name, too. We had an AA wedding. It started with the Serenity Prayer. It ended with the Lord's Prayer. There was a reading from the 12 and 12 in between. I was reminded on that day of the opportunity they gave me in that old reformatory in Ohio to make my collect call back in 1975. And I stood there and dialed, and I dialed, and I dialed. And I couldn't find one person on earth that would accept a collect phone call from me. Not one. We invited 320 people to that wedding. You know how many came? About 360. Do you see the difference? That's the difference in my life today, but there's a difference in me. About 10 or 12 years ago, my stepfather got ill. My mother couldn't take care of him by herself. He had Alzheimer's disease. It's a terrible thing to watch. And I had to help out. And after some dangerous situations, we had to find someplace else for him to go. And we found a nice place for him in Sandusky, Ohio. It's an hour outside of Cleveland, in the old veterans' home. And we'd go visit him on the weekends. And after about 8 months, he passed away. And that left me with an 82-year-old mother at home. And Mom did pretty good for most part. She broke her hip a couple times. She had a couple of minor strokes. But she got around on her walker, and her mind was pretty clear. And she didn't want to go in any kind of a home. So we had that talk. I said, Mom, look, the first few years of my life, you changed my diaper, you fed me, you cleaned up my messes, you took care of me. If I have to do that for you, the last few years of your life, I would be more than happy to do that. And she looked at me and she said, as only a mother could say, she said, the first few years of your life. The first 30 years of your life. I was blessed. Mom didn't have to go in any kind of a home. Thanks to you people, my business partners. I had a woman who took care of her during the day. And after work, I'd go over and I'd have dinner with her and make her dinner. Get her cleaned up, put her pajamas on, and get her to bed safe and sound. And that's what I did during the week. On the weekend, I was there all weekend. And we'd just chat and catch up and do whatever Mom needed done. You know what I like to do on weekends? I like to play golf. Now, I wasn't able to for a long time. I got sick, I had hepatitis C, and went through interferon treatment for it a few times, and it didn't work. But I had friends that golfed. Every once in a while, I'd get a call, and one day a guy calls, and he says, look, we got an opening in the foursome on Sunday. Would you like to play? I said, boy, you know, I'd love to play with you guys on Sunday, but I won't be able to. I'll be with my mother on Sunday. And he said, do you have to be with your mother on Sunday? I said, no. No, I don't have to be there. No, I get to be with my mother on Sunday. I get to be there. I want to share something with you my mother told me. I think it's the most valuable thing she ever said to me. I told you I'd go there after dinner, after work, and I'd get her dinner. Then it'd be time to go to a meeting. And I'd give her a kiss on her forehead. I'd say, Mom, I love you. I'm going to a meeting. And when we tell somebody we love them, wouldn't we like them to say, I love you too? That's what we'd like to hear. I love you too. One particular night I went back. I gave my mother a kiss on her forehead. I said, Mom, I love you. I'm going to a meeting. And she didn't say, I love you too. She said something much, much more important than that. She said, I know you do. I know you do. People should know that we love them long before we have to tell them. Is there somebody in your life? Every once in a while it goes through your mind. I should stop and see them. I should give them a call. I should see how they're doing. Quit thinking about it. It's really hard to make amends at the funeral home. On June 1st, 2005, I was kneeling next to my mother's bed, and I was holding her hand. And at 4:45 that day, the angels came. They took her hand from mine, and they put it in God's. And I was able to do something you taught me to do. And that was to let go and let God. That's the difference. You want to know the big difference? Saturdays, when I'm in town, I go to the cemetery and I put flowers on my mother's grave. I visit my mom. And I'd like to be able to tell you she sees me. I can't prove it. But I'd love to be able to tell you she sees me put those flowers on her grave. Do you know why I put flowers on my mother's grave? The big difference? because I said I would. I'm responsible today. I'm accountable today. I do what I say I'm going to do today. We have a lot of purposes at Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got a primary purpose. We've got a singleness of purpose. My favorite's always been our main purpose, to fit myself, to become of maximum use to my God and to my fellows. Not just here, everywhere. Everywhere. Remember, what you do today between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer, it's not as important as what you're going to do today between the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer. Thank you so much, Georgia, for having me.